A lot of people have looked at some of the same terrain that we've done research on, and one of the earliest reports looking at specifically the tactics that we became aware of being at work in the 2016 election space, which is actually from like 2015 on into 2017, came from a local group, New Knowledge, who made an observation that was echoed in the Mueller report too, that there's a sweeping and sustained social influence operation that was at work with, you know, wielding various disinformation tactics. And if you speak to some of the Russian experts on campus, they would immediately put this particular influence operation in a much broader context, which has been ongoing for a long time, with the very same tactics that have been shown to work in different geographies and in different media over time. So this is a kind of a well-rehearsed playbook on the part of the Russian disinformation effort.
Dr. Sharon Strover studies the sources and impacts of disinformation in media and society. This time on the Plutopia podcast, she discusses her research and findings in a recent virtual meeting of EFF Austin.
Welcome, everyone, to the latest virtual monthly EFF Austin meetup. My name is Kevin Welch. I'm the current president of the board at EFF Austin. See a bunch of old faces and also a few new faces. Welcome to both new and old. So we're very lucky to have back with us Dr. Sharon Strover. She is the Philip G. Warner Regents Professor in Communications and former chair of the Radio, Television, Film Department at UT Austin. She teaches communications and technology courses. She also directs the Technology and Information Policy Institute there. She researches a whole bunch of cool stuff, including local and statewide networks and broadband service, the relationship between economic outcomes and the internet, misinformation, the digital divide, and rural broadband deployment. Her resume is a very impressive group of organizations. She's worked with the European Union, the Ford Foundation, the Rural Policy Institute, Department of Health and Human Services. We're basically, you know, honored that Sharon deigns to spend a bit of her time with us because we are so interested in this stuff and happy to get her expertise on all of it. So I think without me rambling too much further on, I'm going to turn things over to Dr. Strover and see what her latest research has uncovered about the state of online disinformation.
Well, thanks, Kevin. I was thinking back to that talk we gave at a local library, and I was expecting about five people to show up, and it was actually standing room only. I think you were the draw on that, but
I certainly do not know if I was the draw, especially considering that most of the people there were like, I don't know, like they seemed like older homeowners that I'd literally never met before. So
they were, which I found fascinating.
I did too, because it was not your normal like 20 something hacker type who would normally be interested in this stuff.
Exactly. And that says something about libraries. But I think it also says something about how pervasive this subject is, this disinformation, and increasingly we're hearing about misinformation as well, especially around COVID. So, and there's been a huge amount of general purpose newspaper coverage, which we often don't see for topics that like this,
Right. And, you know, just one last thing I'll just say about the event that struck me that I was also impressed with, that, you know, despite it not being a quote unquote young hacker tech savvy audience, I was actually incredibly impressed with the insight of the audience. A lot of the questions they asked, these were people who were informed on this issue. They were not like these were not people getting tricked by like, you know, disinformation masquerading as a meme page. You know, they went against the stereotype of people falling for this stuff. They were very informed.
They were thoughtful and they were trying to be informed, yet they did not know what a meme was.
That's true, actually.
Which actually has led to a research proposal for me, which maybe I'll get into towards the end end of this little talk. So I thank you for the introduction, Kevin, and I'm happy to talk a little bit about what I know or what our research has focused on in the disinformation space. It turns out this topic area has really galvanized a lot of the research community coming from many different disciplines, actually, as well. And by way of background, we have a research institute that looks at a lot of different topics. The kind of core element to it is technology, but technology as it affects social life, as it affects politics, as it affects economics. And so consequently, that laundry list of topics, which really made me feel old, actually, are topics that I've addressed over many years, actually, and some of the currency of them ebbs and flows. Right now, the work I've been doing for, gosh, more than 10 years on broadband, for example, which used to really be relegated to the weeds, suddenly became really current with COVID, because everybody suddenly realized, hey, not everybody has broadband access, not everybody can afford these subscription plans. What can we do about it? So there's been just a surge of interest in all things broadband and all things digital inclusion. This is our current homepage and just some of the topic areas on which our kind of current portfolio is focusing. And actually, this little area on related to good systems is the domain that more or less invited us into the disinformation topic area. We also have another center in my college, the Moody College of Communication, that is squarely focused on propaganda. So I can maybe hook some of those folks up with EFF as it's appropriate too. But good systems is a research challenge in the university parlance. And it's fundamentally interested in the ethics of artificial intelligence. And as everything began to roll out a couple of years ago about the ways in which the Russians in particular were playing the dynamics of our social media platforms, it became a really obvious topic area for us to take a look at so that we could advise, understand, hopefully contribute to the building of better systems in the future that can counter dis and misinformation. And in fact, for the last year or so, we've had monthly talks sharing our research on disinformation. And we just included a couple of talks on misinformation around COVID. The next one and the one for which will wrap up our year is on this week, this Thursday at noon. So let me know if you're interested in COVID misinformation, and there will be some cutting edge research that we can share on that. Actually, it's some graduate student teams that did research over the summer. In any case, I asked Kevin to what extent I really needed to go over some of these ideas with the EFF constituency. He said, there's some pretty sophisticated people in this constituency. So I suspect I don't really need to define the differences between fake news and misinformation and disinformation as well. We're all pretty familiar with things that are just, when you see them right off the bat, absolutely not true, often concocted. And in as much as there's been so much discussion about misinformation recently in the COVID space, I feel it is incumbent on us to underscore that misinformation is even more plentiful than disinformation. Disinformation being defined as politically motivated, poor information or incorrect information. Misinformation is sometimes it's just some crazy stuff. Sometimes it's fear-mongering, conspiratorial, usually without a true political motivation. It's almost difficult to to pick up the paper or certainly engage online spaces these days without constantly wondering if what one is looking at is misinformation. And I was so I've been so struck by some of the damage that misinformation is doing. And this is an image of a local grocery in Houston that apparently a competitor planted a coronavirus rumor that cleared out everybody who was shopping there. And it really hurt this particular supermarket. But disinformation is the politically motivated flavor of online and often offline information that we've been looking at fairly carefully. And there's, as I said before, a large cadre of folks, many of them academics, many of them not, many advocacy organizations, are also really carefully scrutinizing the message spaces on all social media. Our focus specifically looked at Twitter and Facebook, but there are endless and increasingly both interesting and frightening flavors of disinformation. Deep fakes have come to be increasingly prominent, and the deep fake that was circulated in 2018 around the high school student Emma, well, that slide didn't make it in here. I had a photo of Emma Gonzalez, who was a high school student from one of the high schools, Stoneman High School, that had a shooter. And she became one of the activists. And as some of you may know, she was, she made a public talk with some of her fellow activists and ripped up a bullseye from a typical target practice effort. And somebody photoshopped in an image of the Constitution. So she was photoshopped ripping up the Constitution, and that went viral. Incredibly damaging to her, incredibly damaging to her cause as well, even though it was quickly exposed as dis or misinformation. And then, of course, there's been increasing sophistication around memes and what one can do with memes in terms of spreading disinformation and even misinformation as well. And memes have some unique characteristics that distinguish them, of course, from what one sees on Twitter and Facebook. That has sort of, that kind of backs into some of the research that we're engaged in as well. So what we were especially interested in was not so much actually spotting disinformation. And in fact, I've kind of stayed away from that because I think there's a lot of people doing that right now. And we're really fortunate in having people who are kind of scouring the internet and looking for disinformation, including people who are in the government, but also a lot of people who are not part of the government. And we increasingly are able to see that when you see something that has maybe a foreign source behind it, and it seems a little bit crazy, that sends up some warning flags. And the organization of fact-checking efforts has been mammoth. Actually, there are teams working in many, many countries that are working on detecting bots and fakes and false sources and circulating those as fast as they can. And in many cases, they're working with the platform companies in order to identify them. Platforms and what they can do or are doing is another matter. Maybe we can take up towards the end of my remarks. We're interested especially in what happens when people do see these messages, how they respond to them, and why in particular they share this information. And there are some pretty well-known psychological factors. And the fancy term for one of the most popular psychological factor that many of us use to explain why people click on this misinformation or disinformation and send it to all their friends has to do with confirmation bias, which is simply the idea that if something kind of suggests something you already believe, you will circulate it quickly and without really thinking about it very carefully. Confirmation bias also goes along with some of the ways that we as humans process information. And there are characteristics in social media platforms that jibe a little too well with ways of processing information that are not especially rational, that are very quick, and that respond to emotion in particular. And then another psychological factor is very simply our tendency as human beings to believe what we see, to believe what is in front of our gaze without taking the time to think about the clues and about the markers and taking the time to question whether or not what we're seeing is in fact real or believable. And then finally, some research is also beginning to focus on how we can cultivate more responsible information sharing behaviors. If you think about this as, well, the way we think about it as a problem space is that messages and where they come from is one big domain. Platforms and what they do perhaps too well is another kind of domain. And then how people respond is still another domain. And then that can very logically lead into how we evaluate perhaps governmental efforts or other training efforts that can have some bearing on how people can share responsibly. By the way, I can't see anybody on my screen, so I am fine if you want to chime in at any point. I'm really used to that. So feel free to do that if you want to contribute something or if you have a question or something like that.
We have a few people who've been plopping in some questions in the chat.
Totally. Well, if they're appropriate at this moment, feel free. I apologize. I can't see the chat.
A few of them strike me as relevant right now. So like one question we had was prefaced with stupid question. How would you define the difference between fake news and disinformation? Is it just the political intent?
Yes, that's the typical differentiation. Yeah. It's the political intent.
Mm-hmm. And then I have a somewhat meta question of what about anti-D misinfo? Are these based in misinfo or disinfo?
I don't know what that means. You mean,
what is I'm just repeating the question verbatim. Whoever asked it is welcome to rephrase right now.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay, great. First of all, I am so happy to be here that I am just giddy. Anti-DEI was my quick word for anti-diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't want to say just race-based because it could be gender or orientation or anything else. So for those forces that aren't interested in DEI, when they propagate something that...
Yeah, I think that's a really great question, actually.
And thank you for asking it.
Yeah, to a certain extent, it raises questions about the extent to which our perceptions and the way we interact with information is kind of baked into social responses that are racist, and the ways in which some of our systems, not only the way we read, but what is presented to us in various sources is either inadvertently racist or deliberately racist. I know there's a lot of discussions right now in the circles I'm kind of involved with about what's going on with Google and their firing of one of their lead researchers who was trying to get them to take racism more seriously. And it's very, very distressing. Is that misinformation? No, I think it's in a somewhat different category, but some of the same psychological factors may be at work in terms of how people look at the information circulating around those sorts of issues. So maybe that's something we could come back to a little bit later too.
Well, you know, and I guess I'll just say on that one, I still need to do more research about the specifics around that firing, but the particular circumstances to me really, it looks like an example of an inconvenient truth that her research was basically uncovering that massive language model data sets of the kind that are key to Google's ad business may be structurally racist in certain ways in and of themselves. And yes. Google really didn't want to hear that.
Yeah. Yeah. And among the folks looking at machine language and training sets, of course, that is absolutely germane. Those illustrations are absolutely, seminal to thinking about this particular issue.
Thank you very much. I'm going to stay silent. I look forward to hearing to the rest of your talk.
Okay. Well, a lot of people have looked at some of the same terrain that we've done research on, and one of the earliest reports looking at specifically the tactics that we became aware of being at work in the 2016 election space, which is actually from like 2015 on into 2017, came from a local group, New Knowledge, who made an observation that was echoed in the Mueller report too, that there's a sweeping and sustained social influence operation that was at work with, wielding various disinformation tactics. And if you speak to some of the Russian experts on campus, they would immediately put this particular influence operation in a much broader context, which has been ongoing for a long time with the very same tactics that have been shown to work in different geographies and in different media over time. So this is a kind of a well-rehearsed playbook on the part of the Russian disinformation efforts. Of course, now in the more contemporary circumstance, we know that other countries are engaging in similar tactics as well. What we tried to do specifically when we started this project was to look at the Russian campaign specifically and try to figure out a little bit more about what that campaign was, what the messages were, and how they thought the messages might have some impact on us. Of course, it's really difficult to ascertain impact. You need a certain kind of study to really know if a message has a particular influence. And we don't have, a few years down the road, we can't do that kind of research, obviously. We do know that the Russian Internet Research Agency operated its troll farm. This is not directly a government operation. It's actually run by a friend, however, of Putin. So it's an arm's length government effort. And during the 2016 election, interestingly enough, they placed only about 3,500 Facebook-sponsored ads. That doesn't seem like that much to me, and I was kind of surprised to find that. It was only about 3,500 Facebook ads. It was several more tweets, I should say, than that. And the critical dimension, of course, to trying to do this in a social media space is not just those initial placements anyway, it's where they go afterwards. So basically, the Mueller report ascertained that there were over 30 million Facebook ads that were linked to Russia that ended up being shared to a variety of users. And you can do some, if you have access to the data, you can actually do network analyses to figure out what the networks were that circulated and recirculated some of those images. That data, of course, Facebook holds, and Facebook did make it available to a couple of researchers, but after some of the scandals that Facebook went through, they became much more cautious about sharing data for good or for ill. It is interesting that so many people were fooled by these fakes, by the tweets and by the Facebook ads. Even top newspapers, the places that we might turn to thinking, well, these are fact-checked and they're authoritative and so forth, even those reporters, were duped in certain ways. And if you, what did surprise me when I actually looked at those 3,500 Facebook ads is what I'm going to share with you. And maybe, I don't know if how many of you have looked at these ads as well. They were surprising in that most of them didn't really mention the specific political campaigns. There were a few ads that mentioned Trump and Clinton and trashed one or the other of them, but a lot more of them were about issues of immigration, issues of what we might call nationalism, issues of police, and issues pertaining to racism. And we, in fact, did kind of a deep dive into many of the tweets and Facebook ads that apparently were targeting the African-American constituency. The IRA cleverly concocted this fake organization, BM, to kind of play off of Black Lives Matter. And that was a common sponsor for a lot of these ads, which if you didn't really think about it very much would seem like, oh, well, it's Black Lives Matter. But in fact, it wasn't. But this was a very typical sort of ad that, you know, it's sort of a feel good. Here's somebody who created a police reform foundation. Very, very pretty conventional among the set of ads. When Facebook did release the Facebook political ad data, those 3,500 ads, they released them as PDFs. So with two images, basically. One image was the ad itself. The other image was this. It was metadata, basically. And metadata is like gold to a researcher, because this is, we can really work with this pretty easily. And I show it to you just because it's sort of interesting if you've never placed an ad with Facebook to know what you are allowed to select for. And, you know, they include, of course, the text, the locations, which are pretty interesting, the kinds of people or certain factors about the people to whom you want your ad targeted, placements, of course. What I loved about this is that it's paid in rubles. And Facebook was not clued into that for a while, actually. It just wasn't on their radar that, geez, somebody's paying for political ads in rubles. So I thought that was interesting. The ads included issue ads and a handful of fake events. And in fact, we decided to do a careful look at one of the fake events that they promulgated, and it was the event that occurred in Houston. It was one that was written about perhaps a little bit more than a few others, but we found about 40 or so occasions in which the IRA tried to kind of gin up activity around some issue that they thought constituents would have some emotional attachment to. And quite typically, they would place an ad saying, come out and protest about this, and then also at the same time, place a counter ad so that they could very deliberately, which they did in Houston, have a protest and a counter protest. And this is sort of emblematic of what we see in the ad content overall, which is what I'll get to shortly. But there were a lot of fake events that fooled people, that actually brought people out when they didn't know who the sponsors were. We learned, and the Mueller report actually unfolded some of the, revealed some of this as well, that their typical mode in that case was to find a local sponsor at the 11th hour and say, oh, I can't make it, can you take my place? So that somebody who had said, oh, I'm coming, I'm really into this, they would just turn to that, and that would then become the local local sponsor at the last moment, because the Russians weren't going to show up to it. So in Houston, the issue came from the Islamic Center in Houston, which was premiering its brand new library. And somehow the Russian IRA found out about this and concocted a lot of ads around Islamization of Texas. And this is a sample of one of their ads. And they organized a protest, basically. And you can see that then there were some counter ads that, you know, said, hey, if you want to save Islamic knowledge, you should protest. And in fact, there was a small group of protesters, the ones in the foreground of the images on the right hand of your page holding the Confederate flag, and then many more counter protesters who came out once they heard that the protesters were there. So the whole effect was division, fundamentally. It was get people riled up, get people angry at each other. The Islamic Center, by the way, and we've interviewed folks at the Islamic Center, they wanted nothing to do with this in any way, shape, or form. They thought it could lead to violence. They were very unhappy that anything at all was happening. We can come back to that as well, if you like, towards the end of it. So what we've been looking at specifically has a lot more to do with cognition in social media. And we were keenly interested in this quality of emotion that social media forms are so good at invoking and evoking as well. And we sought to look to see if there was anything systematic about the ways in which the sorts of tweets and the Facebook material that we know came from the Russian IRA, and having this known provenance was important to us, if there was any way that this was strategic on their part. So we arrayed the messages and have a metric for their emotional content that we decided to look at over time. And then we also wanted to look at the messages in terms of who were they targeting. When I showed you that metadata page a minute ago, some of them were clearly targeting African Americans. Some of them were clearly targeting progressives or Democrats, people who might be a little more on the left side of the political spectrum. And others were clearly targeting people who were a little bit more on the right side of the political spectrum, populists, nationalists, and so forth, to use terms I'm not that comfortable with, but they create the idea of who they were actually targeting. And then when we looked at the Houston event in particular, we were thinking about how we can apprehend impact at all. But in any case, let me share with you some of what our findings were. This was the timeline of those IRA efforts. And as I said before, that big Cambridge Analytica scandal where it came out that they had shared their data that they weren't supposed to share from Facebook with other sources came up. And of course, from about this period of time on into 2017, the IRA was promulgating ads and was placing its tweets and its Instagram messages and so forth. Congress began its investigation of the IRA in 2018. Many of you probably remember that Facebook hearing with Zuckerberg in summer, April 2018. Congress released data from Facebook and then later from Twitter later on in 2018. In October of 2018. So as of late 2018, we actually had some pretty good data sets to investigate this issue in a more systematic way. And I'm not, this is a very wonky thing just to give you my bona fides, really. But we were really interested in how social media interacts with politics. We were very interested in emotion, as I said before, and we're interested in features of the platform that can kind of interact with these other factors. So this is the wonkiest slide that I think it's the wonkiest. I don't know, you can tell me later.
I appreciate that level. Thank you. And actually, this is going back to something you said a minute ago, but we had one question in the chat. Somebody was wondering whether any of these fake organizations and ads. Was there any things in that that tied into the Unite the Right rallies in Charlottesville? Did that fuel or amplify
yes.
that in any way?
Oh, the Charlottesville. There were, but Charlottesville also had its own independent trajectory.
And that was my feeling as well, that like it wasn't just an IRA operation, obviously, but I think just the question was, did they amplify that, the IRA?
I believe we saw that, but it was not, it didn't rise to the top in terms of volume, the way, say, the Houston event did. Yes.
Gotcha.
That's a good question. So what we did initially was we took a look at all of those, the easiest thing to do, which was the first thing we did, was we took a look at all of those IRA ads. And there's an analytic tool that can actually rate emotion in the text associated with these ads. And one of the first things we wanted to do was to see, well, what are these ads all like angry ads? And I have some examples, and this particular scale rates emotion on about 40 points, from negative 21 for really negative to positive 21 to pretty positive. And this actually was rated as most negative in terms of this particular scale, which is a scale several people have used. It doesn't mean there aren't others. There hopefully will be an even better one in the future. But this was rated as the most negative in terms of sentiment. And again, the measure has a lot to do with the text here. Trying to rate the images is much, much trickier, it turns out. But this was rated most negative. This was rated as most positive. And, you know, I was really surprised to see this ad in the set of IRA ads. It's another one of those kind of feel good ads. And there were a lot of feel good ads in the data set, which were speculating had certain kinds of intentions associated with them. So we had negative, this is positive. Then there are ads like this, which I would have thought would be most highly rated negative. It was rated negative, but not as negative as the one I showed you before. This is obviously one that does directly refer to the candidate in the election, you know, positioning Clinton as the devil and so forth. But the image itself is very emotional. And it, when you look at it, there's you get it right away because of the power of the image itself compared to this, which you kind of have to read in order to understand a little bit more. So I thought that this was very interesting. We had a student trace some of the sources of these ads, and he used the Wayback Machine actually to find that many of the images that were used by the IRA were in circulation. A lot of them came out of Reddit in one way, shape, or form. In fact, many people now believe Reddit is kind of a testing ground for some of the ad content. But when we looked overall, this is kind of wonky, I admit. But when we looked overall at those 3,500 ads or so, what we found was kind of surprising, because the overall sentiment on Facebook was positive. The green is all kind of in the positive range of that scale. The red is negative. You can't see the line at zero. Zero meant neutral, of course. And it was positive. So we tried to, you know, figure out, well, why that was kind of counterintuitive. We did not expect them to be positive. And this is one reason why we started to think about, well, were they positive throughout the campaign? And so we plotted the sentiment scores over time. And this is what we came up with. We found that in fact, when it comes to, again, this is just Facebook, that there was some positivity in those early months of the campaign. And then right before the election, they really took a dive. they got very, they got, well, more negative, I would say. Tweets, by the way, were even more extreme, as you'll see in a minute. But there was a dive right there. And then after the campaign, they became more positive again. So how to interpret this is the question. So we know that positive ads get more clicks and impressions. If you want something to circulate virally, make it more positive. We surmise that that's one reason why early on there were more ads in the positive domain space to kind of get a viral pattern going, maybe get people used to some of these sources so they could like them and invite them into their own groups, and then hit people with more negative ads closer to the election. So this is our kind of working hypothesis, that the positive ads really kind of cultivated an in-group identity early on. Who would those in-groups be? They could include older people, because older people are heavier Facebook users, even in 2016. Now, of course, in 2020, they use Facebook more than younger people do, by far. So that this is one of our hypotheses. It may also be the case that in-group identity and cultivating it was important to establishing a niche with the Black voting population as well. And we have some specific hypotheses around that, that I'll get into in a second, because what we were able to do was to use some of the research that people had done on Twitter to break out who was being targeted in both Facebook and in Twitter. And we call them trolls. So we looked at messages that encoded all of them, and encoded them according to whether they seemed to be targeting people on the left, people on the right, and the Black community. The Black community, as it turns out, is more identified with the left than the right, but we broke them out as a separate constituency. And we did that for both tweets, the set of many, many, many tweets, and for Facebook. And we thought it'd be interesting to see if there are differences in the emotional appeals associated with those particular groups. And there's a lot of theory behind the ways in which social media cultivate group identities. And I'm sure many of you are well aware that Twitter and Facebook and a lot of other sites are really good for giving you a kind of sense of group cohesion. The fancy terms are bonding capital, make you trust people in your group. And this is what we believe is in part at work on some of these platforms. So, I had changed this slide. I apologize it didn't stay here. But I'm inviting you to look only at the left panel here. The left panel is reduced to monthly sentiment scores. It's the same scoring system I showed you a while ago, emotion. And the right-hand panel, which looks really messy, is more granular. It's really broken down into daily sentiment scores. So, but the left one is more interpretable. So just look at the left panel here. And on the upper part, we have Facebook. On the lower part, we have Twitter. And this was quite surprising to us. You know, it would have been a lot more, we would have loved to have been able to say that the Russians used Facebook and Twitter exactly the same way, and they had a concerted messaging that, you know, was somewhat positive at first and then dipped around the election and then went up so that everybody could feel good about the election. But that's not really exactly what we see. So again, we have to explain what it is that we're seeing. We've already talked about this, these Facebook ads and the way there's a dip. It doesn't show up quite as much on this scale, but it's a dip right around the election. And then down here, here's Twitter. And Twitter, first of all, is always negative. It's always, almost always below zero. So it's always negative. It goes a lot more negative than Facebook goes in general. And you see, after the election, it gets pretty positive. And then into 2017, it just takes a really deep dive down. How can we actually explain that? I explain it in a couple of ways. I think that the Russians are smart enough to know there are somewhat different constituencies on these two platforms. Facebook always reaches more people, and it's a more generalized audience as well. Twitter is smaller, it's younger, it's news hounds, and it's news organizations as well. News organizations are heavy users of Twitter. So perhaps that explains why they decided to stay in the negative territory with Twitter, to keep the kind of feeling of being on edge, being, you know, the message of divisiveness, to keep that current. That's one explanation, at least. When we look, when we break out the left versus the right troll here, and I don't know how, if you can see this very well, and I had a somewhat different slide prepared that didn't make it into the deck, but there are some different emotional patterns associated with left versus right here. Again, these are monthly sentiment scores on Facebook. And again, we see appealing to the left, this dip around the election, and then it goes up. The right is a little more consistent, that, you know, it doesn't vary as much. It stays more consistently positive, and there's not as much change overall. When we look at Twitter, we see this huge divergence after the election. Again, it all starts negative for both left trolls and right trolls, but then the left gets positive and the right goes really negative. So why, if the right is the constituency that the Russian IRA really wants to appeal to and wants to congratulate for perhaps electing President Trump, why have all these negative messages? And I have a really simple explanation. I don't really know if it's correct or not, but I think this just increasingly keeps people worked up. If the right is not even allowed to feel good about electing President Trump via these Twitter messages after he's elected, they would feel even worse, it seems to me. And this tendency toward divisiveness would be exacerbated. So I think the divergence is exactly where the strategy resides. Keep everybody on edge, and keep everybody divided and irritated as well. The big picture on this particular slide, again, just looking at the left, is that the utility of this slide is really that we broke out the black representation fundamentally. And here, this line that goes way down, which I would have to admit is based on very few appeals. There's not very many in this set. Goes way negative after the election. But pretty consistently, they're less positive than were the appeals to the right or to the left without the black constituency being included. Here too on Twitter, it's a little easier to see, I think. The bottom line is the black right trolls, and this line is the black left trolls. Also, more negative. So it seemed to us that there were definitely race-targeted handles to get more negative appeals. That's what the data show, at least. So racial identity seems to have been very deliberately targeted and very deliberately targeted with pretty negative messages. Why? We believe it might have had something to do with building that in-group constituency initially and then feeling less interested in voting closer to the election, and then getting angrier after the election to kind of, you know, tune out the Black population. We know for a fact that the Black voters were diminished in number in the 2016 election compared to Obama's election. So this is sort of what we're finding in, and the way we're explaining those patterns. We're certainly hashing this out with our reviewers and so forth. And the other interesting finding, I think, is that Twitter is used a little differently than Facebook when it comes to emotion. It's used, it's much more extreme, and it's much more negative. And I think that has everything to do with that platform, who uses it, and how people use it as well. And the methods of engagement are all there.
Special thanks to EFF Austin President Kevin Welch for allowing us to record Dr. Strover's presentation. You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.